It's my great pleasure to introduce Jack from Hagerstown, Maryland.
There you go. Thank you.
Well, good evening, everybody. My name is Jack, and I am an alcoholic. And I am from Hagerstown, Maryland. I'm a member of the cleverly named Hagerstown Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. We are the third oldest group in the state of Maryland. I think we'll have 62 years this coming September. I'm a member in good standing of that group, and by that I mean I have a sponsor. My sponsor has a sponsor. I sponsor people. I attend meetings of my home group when I am in Hagerstown. They meet Mondays, Thursdays, and Saturdays. They met tonight. And I have a service position in my home group. I'm the current GSR. And I am very happy to be here this evening. I want to thank Bob for inviting me to be here. I think it's real important that you know who is responsible for my being here tonight, because if I say anything that offends you during the next 2.5 hours that we're together, please do not talk to me about that, okay? You talk to Bob, because he's the one that's responsible for my being here. I'm going to put my watch up here, not because I can really see it or pay much attention to it, but I just think it gives hope to the newcomer. I think you all know this, but I think it bears repeating just because this lead is being recorded in case somebody gets hold of this CD. I am not a spokesperson for Alcoholics Anonymous, nor am I an expert on Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm merely a guy who's been invited to come here to share with you my experience, strength, and hope. And as part of that process, I may share with you some of my opinions, strength, and hope. If you're like me, if you're an alcoholic of my type, I don't really like being told what to do. And I understand that you've already been told to turn off those cell phones. But if you got a cell phone with you here tonight, generally when I'm told to do something, I just do the opposite. So just turn those puppies on, will you? Especially if you're awaiting a liver transplant. But if you could, it would be appreciated if you put the phones on vibrate, and that way you can enjoy your incoming call and you're not going to disturb the rest of us. My father is an alcoholic. That is not why I'm an alcoholic. But my mom, who's 92 years old, does not believe that I am an alcoholic. Every time I talk to her before I give one of these AA leads, she insists that I tell you that I am not an alcoholic. My father is an alcoholic. She knows what an alcoholic is. I'm not an alcoholic. But let's see whether or not I qualify by giving you a few snapshots of things that happened to me along the way getting here. I'd like to be able to say, first of all, I thought Samantha did a great job with her lead. Thought that was terrific. Where'd you go, Samantha? I didn't get started as early as Samantha. I got a little late start. I was 15 when I started to drink. But I suspect that alcohol did for me what it did for you. It was indeed the elixir of life. It really took down all those barriers that seemed to separate me from my fellows. Allowed me to do things while drinking that I could never do not drinking. Such as go to dances in gymnasiums, very much like this. To be able to walk across that gym floor and actually ask somebody to dance. Drinking alcohol led me to believe that I could sing. I was sorry that my father was having so much trouble drinking. It was a shame he couldn't control his drinking like I could. And I would like to tell you that alcohol really didn't affect anything that was going on in my life when I was in high school. But I have to tell you, in all honesty, I spent 5 years in high school. And my ego requires me to tell you that was because I wanted to get a solid academic foundation before I went on to college. But the truth of the matter is, it was drinking. It was drinking that caused me to be in high school for 5 years. And so at a very early age, you know, there's drinking with no problems, I thought. But in reality, there was drinking with some problems. And then that drinking, of course, became more problematic until later on there was just nothing but problems. But I'm a little ahead of myself. I went to community college in Hagerstown, and when my good friend Bill and I had decided that summer that we were going to drive to California. And so we got 12 cases of beer, and we put them in the back of my car, and we each packed an overnight bag. I quit my job. I had a pocket full of money from that job. We had no maps on how to get to California. I mean, we're alcoholic teenagers, right? You drive west, and you'll get there. But on the night before we were to leave, Bill's father told him he couldn't go. And so now what am I going to do? I'm not going to drive to California by myself. My car's all packed. I got my overnight bag there, and I got my 12 cases of beer, and I got my pocket full of money. Most of you, I think, probably know that the state of Maryland has a little piece of its eastern border that's on the Atlantic Ocean. And so I drove down to Ocean City. And I spent a month in Ocean City that summer as a bum. By that, I mean I lived in the basement of hotels where friends of mine worked. I ate leftover restaurant food. I would go by the restaurant late in the evening, and they'd give me a half a lobster tail that hadn't been eaten or a leftover crab cake. And so I didn't have to spend any money on room or board. I had my 12 cases of beer to drink, and then when I got finished drinking them, I had my pocket full of money. And I had a great month in Ocean City. In fact, I had such a good time in Ocean City that I decided that I wanted to work in Ocean City the following summer. But I'm a keen observer of my surroundings, and I became aware that in Ocean City, if you were a lifeguard or a beach boy or a bellhop or a waiter or a waitress or a bartender, if you drank like I drank and acted like I acted, there was a pretty good chance that over the course of a summer you were going to get arrested. And I didn't want to get arrested. But I noticed that there was one group of people who were not getting arrested. And that was the members of the Ocean City Police Department. So the following summer, I became a police officer. I was given a boardwalk beat, and no sooner did I start walking that beat than it became apparent that I possess a very unique trait, very helpful for somebody like me who's a policeman who likes to drink, and that is I can spot an underage drinker from 100 yards. And I would walk up to the person I suspected of being underage, and I'd establish through our conversation that indeed they were underage. And I would ask them if I could see what they had in their cooler. And they would tell me, well, what we have in the cooler, officer, is we've got some Coca-Cola and some tuna fish, and we've got some bread. And I said, well, could I look in the cooler? Well, sure. And they'd lift the lid to the cooler. And by golly, right there across the top of that cooler, in a nice, neat row, Coca-Cola, a little tuna fish in a container off to the side, loaf of bread. And then I would reach down into the bottom of that cooler, and I'd come up with a Budweiser. And now the whole tone of the discussion changes. Because if you're that underage drinker, your life has just ended. At least your life as you know it. Because you're going to jail. Oh, I know, you think you're going to go to college, but you're not. You're going to jail. Going into the military? I don't think so. Military's not going to want you. You're going to jail. As a matter of fact, I'm going to take you down to the Ocean City Jail right now. We're going to lock you in a holding cell. And then at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, I'm going to call your parents back in Baltimore, and I'm going to tell them that you are in jail, and they got to come down and get you out. You'd like to offer some alternative to this? What did you have in mind? Confiscate the beer. Well, you understand that if I confiscate the beer, I'm going to have to take the cooler, and if I take the cooler, I'm going to have to take the Coca-Cola and the tuna fish. You're okay with that? All right. I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to write your name right here in my official Ocean City Police log. And don't you ever do this again in Ocean City. You promise? Okay. You're free to go. Now, it's real hard to walk a beat when you're dragging a cooler full of beer around behind you. And so I had to work out a deal with my lieutenant and my sergeant that they would come with their squad car and they would pick up the coolers as I collected them. And then at the end of the shift, I would give them the whiskey and the wine if I happened to acquire some, because I wasn't drinking whiskey or wine then. And I got the cooler and the beer and the tuna fish. I had a great summer that summer. I drank every day. I didn't buy anything to drink all summer. I did not get arrested. That's my definition of a good summer. It was such a good summer, and I went back for a second year. Second year, they gave me a squad car, lights and sirens, all my own. Cruise up and down that beach highway. Really expanded my territory. It was one of those big old Crown Victorias, you know, the ones that have those huge trunks. You can get like 3 bodies in there. 5-6 coolers will fit in there. So I really didn't need my lieutenant or my sergeant. But at the end of every shift, they'd want to come over and see how many coolers I had collected, and they would want to then relieve me of the wine and the whiskey. And if you came down to Ocean City during the summer and you were in need of a cooler, I'm your guy. Stop by and see me. Just a small deposit, no necessity of returning the cooler. Actually, you want to bring it back, that's fine. You want to take it and keep it, that's okay too. Had plenty of them. Had them all stacked up on the back porch. I didn't get arrested that summer. Great summer. So I went back for a third year. Now, what I'm going to tell you about right now is an event that happened during that third year that really changed the course of my life. It was 3 o'clock in the morning. I had stopped this car. The driver was obviously drunk. I got him out of the car. I was writing his ticket for him. And he said to me, "You don't know who I am, do you, officer?" I said, "No, I don't." He said, "Well, I am the state's attorney for Worcester County, the county you're standing in right now." Well, I'm a college kid. I got no idea what a state's attorney is. Never seen one, never heard of one. Don't have any idea what one does. So I said, "Good for you. Sign the ticket." So he signed the ticket. There was a guy in the car who appeared to be sober. I let him drive the car away. I went on about my shift. At 8 o'clock in the morning, when I pulled into the parking lot of the Ocean City Police Department, there stood the chief of police. He said to me, "Quarterman," he said, "bring that uniform citation book and come up to my office." Now, these were the first words that the chief had spoken to me all summer. It seemed to me that I was about to be recognized for a job well done. And I might say I thought it was long overdue recognition. So I went up to the chief's office. I walked into the office. Much to my surprise, seated on the couch right inside the door was the guy I gave the ticket to at 3 o'clock in the morning. The chief said, "Give me that ticket book." I handed the book to the chief. He flipped the book open to the ticket. He handed it to the guy on the couch. The guy on the couch took out a pen and wrote across the face of that ticket, "Case dismissed," and signed his name. It was at that moment that I decided I wanted to be a lawyer. And if I could become one of those state's attorneys, I definitely want to be one of those state's attorneys. Because if you drank and drove like I drank and drove, the ability to dismiss traffic charges with the stroke of a pen was going to come in mighty handy. So I went to law school. Law school interfered with my drinking. There are a lot of smart people in law school. I was not one of them. And so it slowed down my drinking some, pretty much limited me to weekends only. I graduated from law school. I passed the bar. My wife and I got married. We moved back to my hometown, Hagerstown, and I began to practice law there. Been there about 6-7 weeks when I became aware that there was a vacancy in the state's attorney's office, a position of assistant state's attorney. I went right over, knocked on the door, said, "Here I am. Answer to your prayers. When do you want me to start?" Now, what I'm about to tell you is what I thought I heard them say. "I have a problem. I hear things that have never been said." I don't know if that's part of the human condition or part of alcoholism. I think it might be part of alcoholism. And maybe you, like me, have heard things that have never been said. My sister has corrected me any number of times when I tell her about things that I heard my mother or father say. She said, "Jack, that didn't happen at all." And then she tells me what actually happened. But anyway, there I am. Here's what I thought I heard them say. "What? Are you some kind of an idiot? You just got out of law school. You've never tried a case. You've never been in a courtroom. You've never impaneled a jury. You've never examined a witness. Get out of our office." That's what I thought I heard them say. In truth, I believe they said the position has been filled. But I heard what I heard, and I was hurt. I was upset. I was angry. Having been in Alcoholics Anonymous now for a while, I know that what I really had was a resentment. And an alcoholic with a resentment can do a lot. Now, in our community, they elect the state's attorney, probably like they do here in Las Vegas. So I went out and found somebody who wanted to be state's attorney. I ran his campaign for state's attorney. He got elected state's attorney, and he made me deputy state's attorney. I got into that office. We had a serious deficiency. There weren't any badges. There's no point in being a state's attorney if you don't have a badge. The reason you got to have a badge is because you get a badge case, and then you put your driver's license in there. And when they stop you and ask to see your license and registration, you whip out that badge case, and when you hold that up, they don't look at that driver's license. They look at that badge. Oh, the badge officer? Deputy state's attorney, Washington County. No, that's perfectly all right, officer. I understand. You're only doing your job. Yes, sir. No, I'm about 3-4 miles from home. I can make it. Yeah. Well, thank you very much, officer. I really appreciate that. Yes. And you have a nice night off too, officer. I really appreciate the professional courtesy. Good night. Yes. Now, some of you may be getting some insight into why I don't have any DWI arrests in my background. But it gets better. My boss, the state's attorney, was going to be appointed circuit court judge. And the governor, in fact, had him down to Annapolis, our state capital, and told him he was going to be circuit court judge. And if he got appointed circuit court judge, then I was going to get appointed state's attorney. I don't know about here in Las Vegas, but in Maryland sometimes the state senator sticks his nose in where it doesn't belong, screws everything up, and somebody else got appointed circuit court judge. I was disappointed for my friend, the state's attorney, but I was more upset that I didn't get to be state's attorney. I may not be much, but I'm all I think about. And so one night, while having some adult beverages with some like-minded individuals, we determined that somebody ought to teach that state senator a lesson. Somebody ought to run against him. So I ran for the state senate. I didn't know the state senator was going to abandon his wife and children and run off with the secretary from the Appropriations Committee and move to Florida, but he did, and I got elected state senator. Now, in Maryland, when you get elected state senator, they give you a license plate, and on that license plate it says, "State Senator." Now, this is an aid to efficient law enforcement, because when they come up behind you on the interstate and they got those overheads going and they get close enough to see that license plate, they turn those overheads off. They come up alongside of you. They turn those interior dome lights on, and they toot. Beep, beep. Hi, Senator. Hi, Trooper. Hold it down, Senator. Okay, Trooper. And that way you don't have a lot of state police tied up with members of the General Assembly when they could be out arresting real criminals. I'd like to tell you about my experience in the legislature in Maryland, but in our capital, Annapolis, they have a number of people there whose sole responsibility is to see to it that anybody who wants to drink can get a drink at any time of the day or night. These people are called lobbyists, and I had a lot of lobbyist friends. So anything I would tell you about my time in Annapolis would be just be hearsay, and I don't like to spread rumors and things that might not be true. But that guy that got appointed circuit court judge, he didn't like the job, so he quit. So I went over to the governor. In fact, it was on June the 14th, 1977, I went over to see the governor and talked to him about that appointment, and I wanted him to appoint my friend, the state's attorney. And the governor said, no, I'm still very upset about all that adverse publicity from some years back, and so I'm not going to appoint your guy. But I tell you what, if you'd like to be circuit court judge, I'll appoint you. Well, it's a 15-year term, and there's only two of them in our town, so I became a circuit court judge. Kind of frightening, isn't it? Well, I want you to know that under my leadership as circuit court judge, because my father, you see, is an alcoholic, and I know what to do with alcoholics. You send them to Alcoholics Anonymous. So Alcoholics Anonymous and our community was undergoing a tremendous membership growth under my leadership, because I know what to do with you people. Now, as a circuit court judge, I try to be of help to the Bar Association when I could. One night they had a continuing legal education program, and prosecutor was going to put on his what he tried to prove in drunk driving cases. The public defender was going to talk about what he was trying to do in his case. Sergeant Long was there with a breathalyzer, and they needed somebody to drink the beer and blow into the breathalyzer. They needed somebody who was fair, impartial, unbiased. So they brought out six cans of beer, all iced down in a tray, and I said to the guy, I said, what's that? He said, that's the beer for tonight's program. I said, you do realize that this is a two-hour program, and you only brought out six beers. He said, we got more in the back. I said, ice it up and bring it out now, because I'm not drinking any warm beer. And so they brought the beer out, and they warmed up the breathalyzer, and I started drinking, and every 15 minutes, I'd blow into the breathalyzer. And, you know, you start off, you know, with a .04, and it bumps it up to a .09, and you get up there to that .14, and then a .19, and a .23, and then a .29, and then a .33. When I got to that .33 place is where they called upon me to put on my part of the program, which I'm told was pretty good under the circumstances. And after the program was over, I said to the guy who was the chairman of the program, who's going to drive me home? He said, what do you mean? And I said, look, I just blew a .33 in Sergeant Long's breathalyzer. I can't go out and get in the car. Oh, geez, we never thought about that. I said, I'll tell you what, I'll go into the hotel bar and I'll have a few drinks in there. You come in and tell me when Sergeant Long's left. And so after a couple of drinks, they came in and said, well, he's packed up and gone. And I said, good. And so I drove downtown, stopped in at the Broad Axe, had two or three drinks in there, and then went over to the cellar door and had three or four over there, and then I went home, and that was a night of social drinking for the judge. And it was April the 7th, and a lawyer and I had decided that we were going to, I told my wife that we were going out to dinner, but the real reason that we were going out to get drunk. It wasn't one of these situations where we got drunk by accident. I mean, I don't know about you, but I will admit there have been times in my drinking career that I have allowed myself to be negligently overserved, and that's happened by accident. I ended up drunk. I didn't intend to be drunk. But this particular night, we went out to get drunk. knee-walking, snot-flying drunk. No question about it. We ended up in a local cocktail lounge, and let me say parenthetically that I really enjoyed drinking. I enjoyed everything about drinking. I like top shelf. I like bottom shelf. I like imported. I like domestic. When it comes to wine, I would prefer not to have a bottle with a cork in it. I'd like those twists off a lot better. My favorite drink, my drink of choice, by all means, Jack Daniel's Black Label Crushed Ice Twist of Lemon. That's my drink. Although, I must say, I certainly had a fondness for the gin martini. Very much like the gin martini. Particularly like those big olives that you get in a gin martini with those big pits. That's the only place I've ever seen them, is with a gin martini. Although I also tell you that I had a very bad gin experience one time, and even to this day, it's hard for me to go into a pine forest. So, if I'd have known that this was going to be my last drink of beverage alcohol, you need to know, I would have ordered something different. Believe me, if I'd have known that I was going to be asked to come to Las Vegas, Nevada, and talk to you folks about my last drink, rest assured, I would have ordered something else. Because it's really with a considerable amount of embarrassment that I stand before you tonight to share with you the fact that my last drink of beverage alcohol was Tia Maria. Oh, you think that's funny, do you? Well, it's pretty embarrassing. Wait, if you had to be up here. If you're new here tonight and you're thinking about going back out, do not go out for Tia Maria. Trust me on that one. Some of you are probably saying, what in the hell is Tia Maria? Well, you don't really need to know. Just believe me, trust me on this. But in my own defense, I have to tell you, it came out of a tainted bottle, because the reason I know it was a tainted bottle is because I threw up on my way home. And I don't, it's not part of my drinking history. I don't throw up on the way home. Now, if I'm down at the Broad Axe shooting pool or playing shuffleboard, and it gets to be 10 or 11 o'clock at night, and I'm getting a little full, well, you go out behind the dumpster in the parking lot, and you throw up. And you come back in, and you stay and shoot pool and play shuffleboard. That's part of drinking. I understand that. Or let's say you've been out on Friday night and got really rip-roaring drunk. Well, Saturday morning, while on my knees hugging that porcelain altar that's in our, many of us have in our homes, that's part of drinking. And that's part of my drinking experience. Have any of you come up or experienced anything close to the soothing feel of cool porcelain against a fevered brow while on your knees hugging that toilet? Whew! That's great stuff, I'll tell you. I got up, my wife's a school teacher, elementary school. Probably here in Las Vegas, your elementary school children are very much like the school children back home. They're just germ-infested. And the teachers bring the germs home, and the husbands and wives of the teachers get flu. And I got up the next morning, I had flu. I couldn't believe it. But I went to work, and the next day was Good Friday, so the school's courthouse was closed. And so I was home with the flu, and I developed that upset stomach that frequently comes with flu. And then on Saturday, I developed that lower tract distress that frequently comes with flu. And if you've got that lower tract distress coupled with that upset stomach thing, I mean, you know that'll hone your decision-making down to a really fine edge, because you don't know whether to kneel or sit, or sit, or kneel. And at some time over that weekend, I made the wrong decision. Now, if you want to talk more about that, see my wife after the meeting. But I'm going on. Sunday was Easter Sunday, still had the flu. Monday, I was very dehydrated from all that kneeling and sitting I'd been doing, so they put me in a hospital. That night, my abdomen became distended. They performed an emergency laparotomy on me. They found my abdomen was full of gangrene, peritonitis. Trying to clean that up, my kidneys quit. My pancreas started to digest itself. My liver was out of whack, and my respiratory system quit. Things weren't looking too good for the home team. So I spent 3 weeks in intensive care in the Hagerstown Hospital. They did get me off the respirator, but they couldn't restart my kidneys. My pancreas continued to digest itself, and my liver was still out of whack. Sent me down to Johns Hopkins Hospital. They told me that I thought I was going down there to get well. They told my wife that they were sending me down there to die because they didn't know anything else that could be done for me. But if anything could be done, maybe Johns Hopkins could do it. I knew people who had gone to Johns Hopkins and who had lived, and I knew people who went to the Hagerstown Hospital and died. So I was encouraged going to Johns Hopkins. So after 2 weeks down there, they came in and said, well, one, they couldn't tell me what I had. They presented my case to the internal medicine department. They couldn't get a majority vote. They also said there was nothing more that they could do for me. And so on the next day, May the 14th, my belly button birthday, they left me alone. And 2 weeks later, on May the 28th, I walked out of Johns Hopkins Hospital. My kidneys started up again, my pancreas stopped digesting itself, and my liver started to go back to normal. And when you're in a hospital like that for 7 weeks, they want to talk to you about what you had so they know about the do's and don'ts. But since they didn't know, I mean, I had an undiagnosed illness, so they didn't know what to tell me. They just told me, don't get it again, Judge, or it's likely to kill you. So I maintain now that it's better to survive an undiagnosed illness than to die of a known cause. I think that's sound. So I'm just about to walk out of that doctor's office, and one doctor says to me, can we ask you a question, Judge? And I said, what's that? Do you drink? What kind of question's that? Well, sure. I mean, I'm a lawyer. Well, I used to be a lawyer. Now I'm a judge. When I was a lawyer, I drank with clients. I had to drink with other lawyers. I drank with judges. Now that I'm a judge, I have to drink with lawyers. I drink with other judges. Of course I drink. Why? How much do you drink? Oh, not too much. Well, we'd like you to quit drinking for a while. Why? Well, because alcohol really knocks the hell out of your kidneys, and we just got your kidneys restarted, and we don't know what drinking would do to that. Nothing damages the pancreas more than drinking, and your liver, nothing harms the liver more than drinking. So we'd like you not to drink for a while. How long? A year. A year? A year? Well, I haven't had a drink since April the 7th, and this is May the 28th. Okay, I think I can do that. No, Judge, they said, you don't understand. This is Memorial Day weekend. We want you to not drink from June the 1st. Now, I think there are people in here right now who recognize the injustice that these doctors were trying to foist upon me because I was getting no credit for my 7 weeks of continuous sobriety. Well, I want you to know I fought for those 7 weeks, and an argument broke out between these learned physicians and this knuckleheaded judges about whether or not the date that I would resume drinking would be April the 7th or June the 1st. We reached a compromise. I would not drink until next April the 7th. And then if I thought any of the misery, pain, and suffering that I just endured had anything to do with drinking, then I would not drink until June the 1st. And then after that, I was free to do whatever I wanted to. And I walked out of the Johns Hopkins Hospital on May the 28th, not drinking, into the most insane period of my life. In the big book, it says in the doctor's opinion, you take alcohol away from an alcoholic and we get restless, irritable, and discontent. Well, I don't know about you, but that was an understatement in my case. I was pissed off in a spring-loaded position. That's what I was. When I was drinking, My wife and I were separated on three separate occasions, and there were women involved. And after I stopped drinking, my wife and I were separated on three separate occasions, and there were women involved. Now, I think that's pretty clear evidence that drinking had nothing to do with any of those separations. But alcoholism had everything to do with all six of those separations, and we didn't know it. We did not know it. Now, if I don't screw this thing up, come August, my wife and I are going to be married 42 years. Stand up, honey, and let them see you here. Now, you might want to give her a chip for that after this, after this thing's all over. Here I am not drinking and not changing. Disaster for an alcoholic. It's very similar to don't drink and go to meetings. Absolute disaster for an alcoholic. If you're telling people don't drink and go to meetings, please stop it. We're killing people saying that. Tell them don't drink. Go to meetings. Get a home group. Get a big book. Get a sponsor. Take action on the steps. Get a new way of life. That saves lives. That doesn't kill anybody. I am certifiably insane. I hold a prominent position in our community. I'm not drinking and I'm not changing and I'm going crazy. And there are two guys in our community who are watching me die of untreated alcoholism. Both members of Alcoholics Anonymous. One, a guy named Bob who ran our treatment program at the hospital. The other guy, Ken, was a lawyer. And I had hired him out of law school because first he was a good lawyer, but also because he drank like I drank. And we drank a lot. And then when I became a judge and he didn't have my leadership, his drinking got out of hand and he ended up in Alcoholics Anonymous. A sad tale. But they saw that I was dying of untreated alcoholism, and Bob said to me, Jack, well, let me back up and say, on July the 3rd, 1968, my dad, the alcoholic, was walking past a Methodist church in our town, and the pastor put out on the board, don't buy a fifth on the third for the fourth, on July 3rd. My dad went to Alcoholics Anonymous that night and never drank again. He died with 15 years of continuous sobriety in this wonderful program. And I owe a tremendous debt of gratitude to Alcoholics Anonymous, and for nothing else, for my dad's life. You gave him back his dignity. You gave him back his integrity. You gave him back everything that's valuable in life, all those priceless things that money will not buy. Well, Bob knew that my dad died 15 years of sobriety, and he said, Jack, we got this book in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's called The Big Book. Maybe you'd like to read it, find out about your dad's illness. Clever guy, that, Bob. I think you know and I know if he said, Jack, I think you ought to read this book, find out what's wrong with you. Well, there's nothing wrong with me. I'm definitely not alcoholic because I'm not drinking. And everybody knows alcoholics drink. So I read The Big Book. And it didn't surprise me at all. My dad's in there. He's a real alcoholic, as described by the Big Book. What surprised me was that I'm in there. I hadn't counted on that. Bob and Ken, they'd counted on that. And so I was willing to concede to my two friends, Bob and Ken, that maybe, possibly, there was a slight chance that I may have contracted a very mild case of Alcoholics Anonymous. Caught it just in time, just in time. And Bob and Ken began coming to my chambers every Friday afternoon at lunchtime, and they would bring their big books, and I had my big book. And we would read the big book together, and they would tell me the importance of what we had read, and I would explain to them as Jack sees it. And we had quite a few intellectual discussions in my office on Friday afternoon. Friday after Friday, week after week, month after month, they came to my office and we talked about the big book and the program of recovery of Alcoholics Anonymous. And our discussions were all theoretical from my end and all very practical from their end. Because they were giving me the program of recovery of Alcoholics Anonymous, whether I wanted it or not. Because they knew I was dying of untreated alcoholism, whether I knew it or not, or whether I believed that or not. Didn't make any difference. The fact was I was dying of untreated alcoholism. And they knew there was a solution. And they knew that they knew something that I didn't know. And they also knew, if I knew that they knew something that I didn't know, the mere fact that I knew that they knew something that I didn't know and I didn't know what it was that they knew that I didn't know would make me angry, knowing that they knew something that I didn't know and I didn't know what it was. But they were consistent and persistent in delivering the program of recovery of Alcoholics Anonymous to me because they knew there would come a time when actually I would actually know what it was that they knew that I didn't know. And when I found out that I knew what it was that they knew that I didn't know at that time, but now that I knew it, and they knew that I knew it, they knew that by my knowing it then, I wouldn't be angry because in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know when you know that you know. Now, if you followed any of that, you're in the right place. And if you found that to be the least bit confusing, you're also in the right place. Just means you don't know. December 22nd, 1989 was a Friday before Christmas. The courthouse was closed, so we couldn't have our big book discussion in my chambers. So the three of us went out to lunch. My wife and I were separated yet again. I had an apartment. After lunch, we went our separate ways. I went back to my apartment. Propped against the door of my apartment, there was a box, a Hickory Farms cheese log box. One of these things you only see it at Christmas. Somebody sent the judge a sausage or a cheese log. I thought that was nice. Think I'll go in, have a little snack, take some messages off my answering machine. I want you to know I had plans for that night. I had plans for Christmas. I had plans for New Year's. I had plans well in to the next year. I've got that box in my hand. I'm trying to figure out how to get it open. While I'm listening to the answers on my answering machine, I slit the tape with my car keys, and I lifted the lid of that box, and boom! And I got blown back against the wall. And 10 days before that, a federal appellate judge in Birmingham, Alabama, had been killed by a bomb that had been sent to his home. 5 days before that, a lawyer in Savannah, Georgia, had been killed by a bomb that had been sent to his office. And I could smell the gunpowder, and I knew that I had opened a bomb. And there was a fire, and I tried to put it out, and I couldn't. Went out in the hall and pulled a fire alarm. Neighbor came, said he had a fire extinguisher. I went back and called 911. They said, police, fire, or rescue. I asked if I could have one of each. When I went to dial that number, it was the first time I became aware. When I went to push down those buttons, I became aware that part of my right hand had been blown away. When I hung the phone up from that telephone call, it felt like somebody was trying to pull the pants off my hips. And I looked down at the floor, and I was standing in a puddle of blood, and it was just getting bigger and bigger and bigger by the minute. And I knew I was in serious trouble. And my neighbor came and asked if he could do anything else for me, and I asked him to get me a towel. And he got me a towel, and I opened my trousers, and I didn't have the courage to try to visualize where I'd been injured. I just put the towel where I thought the wound was, and I put my back against the wall, and I slid down onto the floor. And it was pretty apparent to me that I was going to die on that floor that afternoon, and I wasn't ever going to see our three children again. And I wasn't going to see my wife again. And I was terribly frightened. And I was powerless. And I didn't know what to do. During the time that Ken and Bob and I had been meeting to talk about the big book, they had encouraged me to go to AA. And I wouldn't go to meetings in Hagerstown, but I did go up to Chambersburg, Pennsylvania, and over to Frederick, Maryland, and down to Martinsburg, West Virginia. And I would go late and I would leave early, but as you know, some meetings of AA don't start on time. And so I'd learned one thing and one thing only in those visits to Alcoholics Anonymous, and that was I learned the Serenity Prayer. So laying on that floor that afternoon on December 22nd, I reached for the only tool I had, and I asked God to grant me the serenity to accept this thing which I could not change, and the courage to change what I could, and the wisdom to know the difference. And I prayed that prayer, and I prayed that prayer, and I prayed that prayer, and I prayed that prayer. And I can't tell you whether it was the fourth, fifth, or sixth time through that prayer, but I can tell you this, God came. And I was overcome by a sense of well-being and peace and serenity, the likes of which I've never experienced before in my life, nor have I experienced it since. And I didn't know if I was going to live or die. But what I did know with certainty was that if I died on that floor that afternoon, never to see my wife or our three children again, it would be all right. It would be all right. And the police, fire, and EMT guys burst through my door, and both of my eardrums had been blown out, and they were yelling at me, and I really couldn't hear what they were saying. And as soon as I stopped praying, this tremendous wave of fear swept upon me, and so I told him, you guys do whatever you have to do, and I'm going back to doing what I was doing. And I went back to the Serenity Prayer, and as soon as I did, the serenity returned. And they cut all my clothes off of me, everything but my red and green Christmas socks, and they strapped me to a gurney, and they carried me down three flights of steps and out and into an ambulance. And my little television station in Hagerstown was there, Johnny on the spot, and they got a picture of me going headfirst into that ambulance with my red and green Christmas socks dangling over the end of that gurney. And my socks went around the world that night on CNN. And they took me to the hospital to prepare me for surgery. And they couldn't find my wife and they couldn't find my girlfriend, but they found my sponsor, Ken, and they allowed him to come back to where I was being prepared for surgery. And Ken held my hand and he prayed for me. And we prayed together. And they took me up to surgery and they removed from my groin area a pretty significant piece of shrapnel. Not resting against, but in close proximity to my femoral artery. And I think we all know here tonight that if my femoral artery had been nicked, you'd have a different speaker here. And they took me up to a recovery room, and when I came to the following day, seated at the foot of my bed was my sponsor, Bob. Now let me say this. It's good to have a sponsor. In fact, it's vital to have a sponsor. Because sponsors see things differently. They see things differently. They have a different take on things. And Bob was seated at the foot of my bed, and he was smiling. And I said, Bob, I noticed that you're smiling. What are you smiling about? He said, oh, nothing really, Jack. He said, I just think it must be wonderful to know that you cannot be harmed. I said, Bob, somebody just tried to kill me. He said, oh, Jack, he said, I know. He said, I understand that box you opened contained four pipe bombs. One pipe bomb is more than adequate to kill a human being. Two pipe bombs is redundant. Three pipe bombs is around the bend. Four pipe bombs, Jack, you have made somebody very angry. In point of fact, Jack, man has done his very best to kill you. And the only explanation of your survival is the grace of God. It's good to have a sponsor. I wouldn't have come up with that in a million years. He said, God has work for you to do, Jack. I said, really, Bob? What kind of work does God have for me to do? Oh, he said, Jack, I don't know. I don't know about that. He says, but I knew, though, that it's God's will for you to be a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And in order for you to do that, you're going to have to pray the third step prayer with either Ken or I. You're going to have to do a four-step inventory. You're going to have to start to uncover and discover that's what's been blocking you off from the sunlight of the Spirit. You're going to have to do a fifth step with me or with Ken. You're going to have to make that six-step decision. You're going to have to pray that seven-step prayer, make that eight-step list, begin making those ninth-step amends so you can live in 10, 11, and 12 and become a maximum service to God and to your fellow man. Good to have a sponsor. I wouldn't come up with that either. I was released from the hospital on Christmas Day. best Christmas I ever had up to that point. The following Christmas, my wife and I reconciled, and we've been together ever since. And I think I can say without hesitation or reservation or fear of being contradicted that our life together today is better than it's ever been. And I owe all of that to a loving and gracious and caring God and the program of recovery of Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're new here tonight, or if you're coming back, stay here. There's nothing here designed to harm anybody. Any pain that I've ever experienced in Alcoholics Anonymous has been a direct result of my insistence on having things my way, insisting on doing it Jack's way. And all that has ever done is not only cause harm and pain for myself, but for people that I really care about. And I don't mean to hurt people, but left to my own best thinking, I hurt people. I had what I like to call cake mix sobriety. By that I mean I had been reading and no action. If we went out here to the grocery store and got a package or a box of that Duncan Hines Red Velvet Cake Mix, on the back of that package, Duncan Hines has a three-step program for the production of a red velvet cake. And I could have that package up here and I could read it to you, or I could give it to one of you to read to me, or we could pass it around the room and read it to each other. But I'm the kind of guy, having read the back of that box, I'm looking for my red velvet cake. I'm in my office every Friday reading the big book with Ken and Bob, and I'm looking for recovery. I'm not taking any action. I'm just reading the package, and I get no recovery. So when I got out of the hospital, I began to get busy in this program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and my life has been transformed. I can't begin to tell you the number of wonderful things that have happened to me, to my family, and to countless others. In the big book, it says, if we get ourselves related in a right way to the God of our understanding, great events will come to pass for you and countless others. And great events have come to pass for me and countless others. Earlier today, I had the opportunity to go over to the detox. I think, what is it, Westcare? It was a great event that came to pass for me. Tonight is a great event that has come to pass for me. The more that I'm in, longer I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous, the less I really know. And yet what I find out here is that it's not about knowledge, it's about action. People talk about gratitude. And gratitude is not just something to be felt. Gratitude is something to be acted upon. You know, it says we're going to have a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. And then we demonstrate our gratitude by carrying this message to alcoholics who still suffer. And there are alcoholics here tonight who are suffering. And I'm not talking about somebody who's here with 30, 60, or 90 days. I'm talking about people who are here with a couple of years. If you're here tonight and you're not happy, joyous, and free, talk to your sponsor, because you're doing something that you shouldn't be doing, or you're not doing something that you should be doing. Because this program guarantees me that I get to live happy, joyous, and free if I do the deal. It says in our book that these principles, which are spiritual in nature, if practiced as a way of life, will remove the obsession to drink. And that is a good thing. But more importantly, it says it'll render the sufferer, and that's me, it'll render the sufferer happily and usefully whole. And it turns out that's the very thing that I've been looking for all my life. It's the very thing that I was chasing in that bottle. I was looking in that bottle for something that would render me happily and usefully whole. And I find out in Alcoholics Anonymous how to do that by taking action on steps which I think don't apply to me, by doing stuff that I think will not work, and getting results beyond my wildest dreams or imagination. Most people that I know outside of these rooms go through their lives wondering if God exists. And you and I get to watch God work on a daily basis. We are a blessed people. We have been given a tremendous gift, and we have been given a tremendous responsibility. I know this for a fact. I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous tonight because somebody prayed. I'm confident that my wife prayed. I'm confident that our children prayed. I'm confident that my mother prayed. Not that she thought I was alcoholic, she just thought I was crazy. Somebody please help my son. I'm here because a lot of prayers were lifted up. I'm also absolutely certain that every one of us here this evening who's alcoholic, every one of you who's alcoholic, are here as a direct result of somebody praying. Maybe a lot of somebody's prayed. Now, maybe you don't like me, like hearing me say that. Well, I'm sorry about that. And I don't care. It's a fact. You didn't get here by accident. You got here because somebody prayed. A lot of somebody's prayed. Now, here's something that you can agree with me on because you know it's true. And that is that the people who are in this room right here, right now, at this moment, have never been assembled together before in the history of the world. And we will never be assembled together again, ever. And our book says there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now, right here, right now. Think about all the twists and turns that had to occur in your life to bring you here to this meeting right here and right now. Consider all the twists and turns that I had to go through to get me here to this meeting tonight right here, right now. There's somebody here tonight who fully intended not to come to this meeting. There is somebody here tonight who said, I don't want to go to that meeting. And somebody else said, get in the car. Somebody has been here, sent here this evening to hear something that I have to say. I don't know who that is. And I don't have to know. I just know that because I suited up and showed up and did the deal, that I became an agent of God. And that gives me the whim-whams. Because I don't feel qualified. I don't feel qualified. Bob, agent of God. David, agent of God. Stephanie, agent of God. Jeff, God's agent. I didn't sign up for this. I just came here because I wanted to stop hurting and I wanted to stop hurting people. And God said, I have work for you. I am to fit myself to be of maximum service to God and to my fellow man. I've got a pamphlet here, one of our conference-approved pamphlets. It's called A Member's Eye View of Alcoholics Anonymous. I hope you've read it. I think it's the finest piece of AA literature we have outside of the big book. That is my opinion. If you have not read this pamphlet, you don't have an opinion. So why don't you get a copy and read it and see what you think. I'm going to read to you something that's at the very end of this pamphlet. This coming Sunday, in the churches of many of us, there will be read that portion of the Gospel of Matthew, which recounts the time when John the Baptist was languishing in the prison of Herod. And hearing of the works of his cousin Jesus, he sent two of his disciples to say to him, Art thou he who is to come, or shall we look for another? And Christ did as he so often did. He did not answer them directly, but wanted John to decide for himself. And so he said to the disciples, Go and report to John what you have heard and what you have seen. the blind see, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead rise, the poor have the gospel preached to them. Back in my childhood catechism days, I was taught that the poor in this instance did not mean only the poor in a material sense, but also meant the poor in spirit, those who burned with an inner hunger and an inner thirst, and that the word gospel meant quite literally the good news. A number of years ago, two men, Ken and Bob, working singularly and together, maneuvered me into Alcoholics Anonymous. Tonight, if they were present and they were to ask me, "Tell us, Jack, what did you find?" I would say to them what I now say to you. I can tell you only what I have heard and seen. It seems the blind do see, the lame do walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead rise, and over again, in the middle of the longest day or the darkest night, the poor in spirit have the good news told to them. God grant that it may always be so. My name is Jack. I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date is April the 7th, 1982. Thank you for letting me share.